And his subject for us, Just Say Oh No to Oh No. Just Say Oh No to Oh No. Brother Carl.
Brethren, I'd like to open with a question. Probably the last ancient worthy to die who's mentioned in the Old Testament is Malachi. But who was the next to last ancient worthy to die in Old Testament times? Anyone have an idea who was the one who died previous to Malachi, or about the same time almost, of the Old Testament characters? That's what we're going to talk about today. It's Nehemiah. Nehemiah lived and died somewhere in the 5th century B.C., probably dying around 410, 415 B.C. We'd like you, those of you who have your Bibles, to turn with us to the 6th chapter of Nehemiah. We're going to pick up a story that, almost a story in the middle. And as we pick up the story, we want to follow one thread of a lesson. And that is how Nehemiah handled the tremendous opposition to the work that he was doing. You may recall Nehemiah was originally a valet or butler, actually the cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. And he sought permission to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the walls of the city. He got back to Jerusalem, he found the walls in tremendous disrepair. He carefully went out, laid out a plan for building the walls, and construction began. There's a saying, the nature abhors a vacuum. When Israel had been taken captive by Babylon, the Middle East didn't stay uninhabited. Neighboring tribes soon came in and started farming the land, took over the land, and they set up their own communities there. There were two particular neighbors that dominated the land around Jerusalem. The Moabites, who were led by a man named Sanballat, and the Arabians from further down in Saudi Arabia today, they were led by a leader named Geshem or Gashmu. Connected with these was a third man who was not really a leader. He was an officer, a servant of the others, but he plays a very important role, as we'll see, a man by the name of Tobiah. And these are the three who are the enemies of Israel: Sanballat, Geshem, and Tobiah. Pick up a reading in the first verse of Nehemiah 6. Now it came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arabian and the rest of the enemies heard that I had builded the wall and that there was no breach left therein, although at that time I had not set up the doors upon the gates. The setting is, the wall is almost complete. There are no breaches left in the wall. Everything is done except the actual putting in of the gates themselves. Prior to this time, this coalition of three enemies had tried to stop the wall building by actual force. And you may recall that the builders of the wall, rather than being stopped, worked with the trowel in one hand and a sword in the other hand to defend themselves against attacks. There was a second approach to send an envoy to Artaxerxes to try to poison Artaxerxes against the work that was being accomplished by Nehemiah. That failed. And so the wall was almost complete as we enter into the story. But as long as the gates are not up, there is still the possibility of the enemies infiltrating. And so they're trying to stop the wall even at the last minute. And there are several stratagems that this trio under the leadership of Sanballat try to use. We're going to look at those stratagems, look at the reaction of Nehemiah to those, and then draw some lessons for those in our own personal lives. So let's go on in Nehemiah 6, and we're going to read verses 2 to 4. Then Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, Come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plains of Ono. But they thought to do me mischief. And I sent messengers unto them, saying, I am doing a great work, I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and come down to you? Yet they sent unto me four times after this sort, and I answered them after the same manner. It isn't too evident, but it's there between the lines, that the first strategy that the enemies were going to use was an ambush. That's what he said. He sought to do me harm. So we need to talk about this. Let's work out a peace treaty. Now let's go to neutral ground. About 30 miles from the city of Jerusalem lay a little village. A little village called Ono. So let's go to Ono and we'll meet there. Now to get to Ono, you've got to pass through a very rugged mountain pass. The very pass where Jerusalem, where the Jews in 1948 stopped the Arabs. The pass that they won to win entrance into the land. That's the pass you'd have to go through between Jerusalem and Ono. And so when he was invited to come to Ono, Nehemiah said, oh no, I will not go. That will not be my destination. He foresaw the plot, but he uses as his primary reason what is in truth the primary reason. I haven't got the time. I'm busy doing a great work, and I will not be diverted from the activity the Lord has put before me. That will be my stress, and what you do, that's your problem. What I do is serve the Lord to the best of my ability. That, my brethren, is a stratagem the adversary uses against us all the time. He would have us arrive at compromises. He would invite us to the plains of Ono. Let's talk about it. Let's find a modus vivendi, a way to live together. And our reaction must be, I haven't got time. I'm too busy doing an important work. I'm building walls. I'm putting up gates. I'm putting up entrances in my life. I'm building a strong character. That must be our reaction. Whenever we're asked to compromise, those are the onos that come our way, and we must always say, oh no, I will not take the time to divert. If you're attacked by rumor, if you're attacked by somebody making a charge against you that's false, don't bother with answering it. Leave it in the Lord's hands. Plow on with the work you seek to do. Because all the other would do is divert. For every answer you give, there'll be a new charge. There'll be another charge. And you'll have your whitewater gates and your water gates and whatever they be. That will take place, that there'll be charge after charge to follow. Merely slowing down the activity that we should be engaged in. And they sent to him four times after this matter. You know, the question was once asked of a scholar, said, you find something good in everybody. What can you find good in Satan? He said, well, at least he's persistent. And that's what you have here. You've got the persistency. There is this constant repetition, the repetition of a charge, an accusation, a hint of compromise. The adversary isn't discouraged if you say no the first time. Keep coming back. He comes back over and over and over again. I've always enjoyed the saying they have of the time that the adversary wanted to use the imp of discouragement. And he sent the imp down and said, discourage that Christian. And the imp sat on the Christian's shoulder and said, you're discouraged. And he said, I am? Yes, you are. Well, I don't feel too good right now. No, you're discouraged. Yeah, I guess I am a little down. You're very discouraged. And pretty soon he depressed. And the imp went back and said, got him. He said, take the next one. And he sat on his shoulder and he said, you're discouraged. And the Christian said, I am not. Yes, you are. You're very discouraged. I am not discouraged. Oh, but you are. I am not. Get out of here. And the imp went back and said, now I'm discouraged. We must discourage discouragement. We must treat it in the way that Nehemiah treats his invitation with Ono and come out with that firm, oh no. When Nancy Reagan invented that saying about drugs, just say no. That's the concept we need here. Just say, oh no. Just have that positive resistance to any suggestion of evil with the recognition that the suggestion will come again and again and again and again. It will be repetitive. Well, when that suggestion didn't work, Sanballat wasn't finished. So let's go to his next strategy, verses 5 to 7. Then sent Sanballat his servant unto me in like manner the fifth time, with an open letter in his hand, where it is written, It is reported among the heathen, and Gashmu saith it, that thou and the Jews think to rebel, for which cause thou buildest the wall, that thou mayest be their king according to these words. And thou hast appointed prophets to preach to thee in Jerusalem, saying, There is a king of Judah, and now it shall be reported to the king, Artaxerxes, according to these words. Come now, therefore, and let's take counsel together. They say, you won't listen to my private invitations? I will try the famous strategy of peer pressure. I'll get a rumor started in the land. And by this rumor, others will encourage you because they'll say, it's going to fail. This whole thing is they misunderstood, is they misinterpreted. We better seek a way to get this worked out. That's the next approach, the approach of rumor. You know what makes a rumor so powerful? Usually it's not totally wrong. Just a little grain of truth. And that grain of truth makes it credible. Now, I think the rumor that he started probably had a big grain of truth. I think that when he said that you commissioned prophets to say there's a king in Israel, I think probably Nehemiah did just that. I think that Nehemiah, who was a reformer as well as a wall builder, was encouraging him that the time has come, there is a king in Israel, but it's not me. It's God. He's pointing to God as being the king. And he's pointing to the fact that in this king, you will have your faith and not in Medo-Persia, even though they're the ones who have sent you here. What is misinterpreted is not the fact that Nehemiah said there was a king, nor that Nehemiah said we are independent, we're under God. But what was misunderstood was that Nehemiah meant to use this for political ends, for current ends. You know, in recent years, one of the things that we were interested in hearing when we were in Romania, shortly after Ceausescu was assassinated, was the charge that was leveled that brought most of the brethren who went to prison, into prison. The charge that was leveled mainly was, is it true that your theology preaches that there's going to be a kingdom on this earth that plays all the kingdoms? I said, yes, that's true. That's treason. Say you're preaching against the current regime. That's a false extension. It's the same false extension that's made here. Nehemiah preached a future kingdom. Nehemiah preached a king. Nehemiah did not preach that Nehemiah was that king, nor that that kingdom would be them, nor did he build the wall for the purpose of that kingdom. That was the false conclusions that were drawn and made into the scandal against him. We preach a kingdom. We preach a kingdom that will replace the kingdoms of this earth. We preach the collapse of the kingdoms of this world. We preach the collapse of the religions of this world. We are not insurrectionists, because we are preaching it in God's time, in God's manner, by God's methods, and not by our involvement in political strategy to do it now. And so this was made into the rumor. And he said, now with this rumor, and we're publishing it far and wide, so that others, well, you see how you misunderstood, and they're going to put pressure on you, clear it up. He said, don't take the time. Oh no, I'm not going to get caught in that strategy. We can be writing letters forever, and you're just trying to lure me out to Ono. You're trying to, again, bring me to this conference. Now, there are times you hear charges. Maybe not about yourself, maybe about somebody else, about your ecclesia, your cult. Now, this is a sect. Russell. We heard about Russell. He's a bad man. He's did this and this. And you feel we've got to answer these charges. I said, don't worry about it. Keep busy with your work. The charges will take care of themselves. Those who want to believe him will believe them. And those who want the truth will know that these charges are too wild to believe, and they will investigate. You do not need to become the instigator of your own defense. Let the Lord be the one to instigate that defense. Say again, oh no, I will not respond to the wild charges that are made. Notice how the response that Nehemiah gives in verse 8 and 9. Then I sent unto them, saying, there are no such things done as thou sayest. Thou feignest them out of thine own heart. For they all made us afraid, saying, their hands should be weakened from the work, that it be not done. Notice, he said, didn't take time to answer point by point. He just said, not true. No, I got work to do. Don't bother me. He said, all you're trying to do is weaken our hands. Trying to drive a little division in. That's another favorite weapon of the adversary. He loves wedges. He puts a little wedge in, a little point of difference, and he taps on it. Taps on it, tap, 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 and pretty soon, the smallest wedge can break the biggest stone. And he separates. And then he says, now we'll do this. It's the old philosophy of Caesar, divide and conquer. That was the tactic he was trying to use here. Divide the people. Take away from the unity that was established in them in building these walls. Now we come to perhaps the most subtle of the strategies. The third strategy. Verse 10. Afterward, I came to the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Ahinabeel, who was shut up. And he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us shut the doors of the temple, for they will come to slay thee. Yea, in the night they will come to slay thee. Now, the people he mentions are not common names to you and I, but they were common names there. These were people of prominence that he had gone to. There was a little confusion on this one phrase that says he was shut up. Some take that as that he was an invalid. And that may very well be what the phrase means. Other take it that he was already suspected of being a traitor and he was under house arrest. He was shut up for that reason. I'm more inclined toward the thought of he's an invalid because it seems to come in later in the story as it develops. We know there must be a reason for telling us that or he wouldn't put it in here, that he was shut up, whatever that phrase means. But he was at least confined for one reason or another to his house. And so Nehemiah had to go to him. He couldn't come to Nehemiah. And the implication is he sent for Nehemiah to come. And he said, I've gotten pretty clear word that they're planning to assassinate you right here in Jerusalem. And he said, there's one place that they can't reach. That's the holy confines of the temple, especially if we lock the doors. So the idea was to bring him to the temple. Now, this would not slow down the work, because they want to do this by night. He mentions when they want to assassinate him by night. So he can't use the same excuse, I'm too busy. Now, this time, it doesn't interfere with the work. He's only worried about the nighttime hours. So it sounds like a very logical suggestion. Very attractive. Why waste, take any risk when you can put yourself in a place of safety? Hold yourself up in the temple. And Nehemiah's reaction is an interesting reaction. Verse 11. And I said, should such a man as I flee? And who is there, being as I am, would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. Should such a man as I? That's a very interesting expression. What does Nehemiah mean when he says, such a man as I? I'm going to give you three possibilities, and I'm going to suggest all three are right, that these are not antagonistic possibilities. First, I think there's a lot of courage in it. Not braggadocio, but courage. Conviction that he does not need to fear because the Lord is on his side. Should such a man as I, not pointing to himself in pride, but pointing to himself in confidence, a man who he has set himself to do a work. A man who is convicted that the Lord will be with him at every step. Should such a man flee? No. I would not be worried for my life. I would not even give the hint of being at risk by going to the temple. I think that is a very appropriate meaning to put to the word. But it just scratches the surface. Nehemiah was more than a man of courage. Nehemiah was set there to be an example. He led by example. He didn't direct work building the wall. So you go build the wall and go inside into the planner's office. He was on the wall there with them. He was working with them side by side. Should such a man as I, one who's an example to the people, show an example of flight, what would that do to the people? It would set the wrong example. So he's also saying, in the position I'm in, as a leader, as an example. And brethren, I don't care who you are. I don't care how young you are. I don't care how old you are. You're all examples to somebody. We are a spectacle unto men and to angels. Should such a man as you, given that responsibility of being an example, flee, show fright, show fear in the face of the adversary? No. Should such as each of us have that conviction, the conviction that is born that I will do this because I know the Lord is with it, and not show the fright, so that others don't likewise show the fright and you start a stampede, but rather start a fortified wall. I think that was a secondary meaning to this thing. But I think there's a third one, and it probably is the most important one in Nehemiah's case. Nehemiah's position before he got involved in this work was the cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. That position was an extremely critical position. They did more than bring the wine. The most critical position of that was to taste it first. And the reason for tasting it was to avoid poisoning the king. The king would say, if you don't die, then I can say for me to take it. There was a lot of betrayal, a lot of power politics that's going on. In the book of Nehemiah, if you read between the lines, there's a lot of power politics. Almost as much as in King David's day. That was the day of politics extraordinary. But there's a lot of politics going here. And so the king needed to safeguard this person. He needed to be sure that this person would be as free from temptation as possible. Do you remember who the first butler is mentioned in the Bible, first cupbearer? Back in Genesis. The cupbearer to Pharaoh. And the baker. They were put in prison, you remember? At that time. It tells us something about them back in that story that is borne out historically for almost all cupbearers. They were eunuchs. It was very traditional in the politics of those days to take this sensitive office and remove from it a temptation that was used back then as well as today, the sexual temptations, to subvert them to become aligned with the opponent. And so they would make them eunuchs. Jesus speaks about this. Those who made eunuchs of men. That's what he's talking about. Those who were made eunuchs. So Nehemiah probably was one of these. Had probably been a eunuch because of his position under Artaxerxes. And it was illegal for a eunuch to enter the temple. They were part of a blemish. They could not go into the inner precincts. So the real temptation here is to get the Jews to kill Nehemiah. We can't get him out of the city. Let's get him killed in the city. And they're luring him into the temple. So that being in the temple, now they can spread the charge. And that's why they take a fellow invalid, a person who is himself invalid, and said, I'll go with you. We'll go together. This person would not only be there under a natural pretext, I'm an invalid, a safe place, but also being in the hire, as it's going to come out later, of Tobiah. He's the one to report, I know he was there. I was there with him. We were there together. He's putting him in harm's way. And so often that is the lure. The adversary will draw us into harm's way, not realizing our own imperfections. We each have our own areas where we do not measure up. And it's those areas of our weakness that where the adversary hits us the strongest. Whatever that weakness might be. It might be a weakness for pleasure. And he'll put us in the pleasure area and he'll say, no, there's nothing wrong with a little of this. Or he'll put us into an area where, and maybe it's a little evil speaking, it just happens to be our temptation. And he'll put us into seeing the faults of others. Well, you've got to be honest. You've got to be warning the brethren of this person or that person. Whatever the area, that's where he will lure us into our temples. And that's where we've got to say, oh no. I recognize that's a weakness. I recognize that's something I can't. Should such a man as I, who've got this problem, put myself in this position of temptation? We have to recognize our faults also. It's not only a phrase of pulling up. It's a phrase of honesty. Should such a man as I, in his case, a eunuch such as he. Then he tells why he answers no. Verses 12 to 14. Lo, I perceived that God had not sent him, but that he pronounced the prophecy against me, for Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. Therefore he was hired, that I should be afraid and do so, and notice the next words, and sin. To do so would be a sin for him, and that they might have matter for an evil report, that they might reproach me. My God, think thou upon Tobiah and Sanballat according to these their works, and on the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets that would have put me in fear. These are the ones who are reacting to this open letter. These are the ones who are saying, you better do this, because if you don't, we're going to lose you. And he said, no, I recognize that this is of the adversary. Tobiah hired this person. They're the ones that put him in the position to lure me into temptation. Verse 15. So the wall was finished. 25th day of the month of Elul in 52 days. Just a short verse, just a historical fact. But there's a little lesson I'd like to draw from that fact. Now, at the beginning of each year, we make New Year resolutions. We make New Year resolutions. I'm going to build this wall in my life. I'm going to build the wall of patience. I'm going to particularly work on the wall of love this year. I'm going to particularly work on the wall of being gentle, or whatever our little walls are. And the adversary all year long is going to attack us. But if we are like Nehemiah, we won't do it in 52 days. We'll do it in 52 weeks. We've got 1 week, and then by next year, we've got a new wall to build. And let's make a determination each year to build a new wall for ourselves. And in that amount of time, we can build that new wall, and we can keep going. But you know, even with the wall finished, the enemies didn't give up. And that's what finishes our chapter. And it came to pass that when all our enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen that were about saw these things, they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought by our God. Let's just stop there for a second. The first reaction of the enemies was like that imp said, no, I'm discouraged. They were down. They said, we failed. The wall is built. But they said something else. An amazing thing for such as Sanballat and Geshem and Tobias to say, we know God did it. I said, they knew that it was God's work. Here again we come, brethren, to our presentation of ourselves as being a witness for God. We can say all the beautiful things we want to say, and we should say them. We can give all the messages of learning there are, and we should give them. But it's only if we are successful in building the walls of character in ourselves that others will say, now I know this is of God. They know us. Our neighbors know us. Our co-workers know us. They know our weaknesses. They know we can't do it. And they know if it's done, it was done by higher power than we ourselves. That's where the witness comes, just as it did there. The wall itself became the witness. The opposition was too great, and they still did it. They said, you couldn't do this without God. But they're not totally discouraged. Verse 17, 18, 19. Moreover, in those days, the nobles of Judah sent many letters into Tobiah, and the letters of Tobiah came to them, for there were many in Judah sworn unto him, because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Aaron, and his son Johanan had taken the daughter of Meshullam, the son of Berechiah. Also they reported his good deeds before me, and uttered my words to him. And Tobiah sent letters to put me in fear. The opposition continues. Even after we have built our walls, he's still trying to battle them down. And now the opposition is by infiltration. Intermarriage, in this case, Tobiah is so prominent in this role, not because Tobiah was a great leader. Sanballat and Geshem were the leaders. Tobiah is the servant. But it's Tobiah who had one thing the others needed. He had a daughter and a son that married Israelites in the city. The daughter of the son married the daughter of the high priest. So he had his ear right in the high priest council. He had the best spy placement there was. His own little private CIA. And this information was coming out to him so he could constantly know where the weaknesses were. And the adversary has that in our lives too. We have our places where we're too open to admit, where we let a little too much of the world in our lives, where we open this up, and that's where the temptations keep coming. We've built a wall, but the wall isn't totally secure. We've got to keep it in repair. It's one thing to build it. It's another thing to fortify it. It's another thing to support it, to keep it there. You come to the 12th and 13th chapters of this book, which we're not going to go to now, and you see the tremendous infiltration system that they had with this process of intermarrying. That was always the way Israel's enemies worked. You remember back in Balaam's day, when Balaam couldn't curse Israel, try as he would. He said, I can't curse him, but I can get God to curse him. If you get your daughters to marry their sons, you won't need to curse them. They'll fall away from God. And that was the tactic that was used throughout Old Testament history. That's why Paul speaks so strongly about that tactic in New Testament times. He talks about the tactic of remaining two together to walk agreed, not only in the literal acts of marriage, but all our partnerships, all of our working together should be for a spiritual end with those who are likewise spiritually motivated. That is the lesson he's drawing from us. Time is almost up, but I want to go back and pick up one point I missed that I think is, again, such a fatal point. I want to go back to the rumor. There's one point I didn't mention then. Back to verse 6. In the open letter, he said, wherein was written is reported among the heathen, and Gashmu saith it. Who cares what Gashmu says? Why does he put that in here? Why does he tell us, and Gashmu saith? Who is this Gashmu? Well, Gashmu is the same character as Geshem in the first verse. He's the leader of the opposition. So what difference then does it make? Why does he say that Geshem saith it? 2 points. Name dropping. You can drop a prominent name. Well, it's not only that this rumor has been said, but I heard this from Brother so-and-so. And you drop a very prominent name. And usually, you will find out if that's done, that Brother so-and-so, who is mentioned, is one of those who opposed you in the first place. He's a Gashmu. Gashmu's weight holds no authority, in fact. Gashmu would be the last person you should quote if you know that he's in the opposition. But he quotes him. He quotes him because the name is a big name to the one who is speaking. And that's the weakness to all rumors. Rumors are backed up by the friends of the speaker, not necessarily by the friends of the one being spoken against. And that's why Brother Russell, I think, does so well in recommending and using the principles of Matthew 18. If you take a second party with you, don't take a friend of yours. Take one who's acceptable to the person being charged. Don't take a Gashmu, one on your side, but take one who would be sympathetic to hearing both sides of the story. Get an objective feeling. But there's a second reason for saying Gashmu here, and that is Gashmu is co-leader of the surrounding tribes. And what they're recommending in the rumor is, we're going to be sending this report back to Artaxerxes. We're going to tell Artaxerxes, you've got a plot underway here to rebel. And if we say that even Gashmu recognizes this, Artaxerxes will say, oh, Gashmu, yes, yes, he's the head of this whole people. That must be important. And he'll listen. Gashmu was not important to the people of Jerusalem. It was important to the people in Artaxerxes' court. And there too, we should not be afraid of a prominent name is attached of somebody in authority thinking this was going to influence God one way or the other. God doesn't listen to the most influential brethren. God listens to the heart. He looks at each individual person, and God's judgment is a righteous judgment. Therefore, we need not be afraid of any Gashmus. We not be afraid of this whole area. So let's go back now and look at our summarization. In our lesson, we see that in trying to stop the mighty work of the Lord, Sanballat and Gashmu, along with Tobiah, used 5 strategies. First, outright opposition. Tried to defeat the wall by military power. Second, by advising the king of a plot against him. Third, by invitation to compromise. Fourth, by a rumor through an open letter. And then fifth and finally, by the temptation to sin by going to the temple. That because Nehemiah was constant, because Nehemiah had the faith to always say, oh no, to every temptation, the wall was completed. And that's the lesson for us. That as we work on our lives, as we build the structure of character pleasing to our God, there'll be, through all of these means, opposition. There'll be many invitations to each of us to go and meet the adversary on the plains of Ono. Just say, oh no, to Ono.
Thank you, Brother Carl, for your service to us this morning. Just say, oh no, to oh no. Thank you. May the Lord bless you for your service to us. We're going to conclude this portion of our morning services with the hymn number 4. Hymn number 4. We'll sing it all. We'll rise on the last verse. And we'll ask Brother Carl to dismiss us with prayer. And we'll have fellowship for about half an hour. We'll gather together again at 11 o'clock. Hymn number 4.
Thank you.
Heavenly Father, we now bow our heads before your throne to ask, Father, for the courage and strength to hold ourselves more dedicated to the task of building up the Christ-like character within our lives. Give us the knowledge and the strength to so do. Bless us now in our continued fellowship, that the words we speak one to another may be to thy glory and to our edification. To this end, we come to thee through the name of Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.